In the early 1900s, certain companies were off-gassing highly toxic fluoride gases into the atmosphere. The surrounding communities began to get sick. Laws were enacted to compel these corporations to install scrubbers to convert these gases into fluorosilicic acid, still highly toxic, but containable. Now these companies had a stockpile of this poison, and there was no affordable way to dispose of it. Lucky for them, one of their major stockholders was also the Secretary of the Treasury, who was responsible for the Public Health Service at the time. And by 1950, the U.S. government began buying this toxic, untreated industrial waste product and dumping it into our drinking water. Reputable studies show that it's causing various cancers and other disease. With the Alexa Pure Pro, you can have clean drinking water and a remedy to this madness. Available now at InfoWarsStore.com.
Rampant hacking, identity theft, mass surveillance. Defending yourself today is not an option. It's a requirement. Introducing the Conceal Shield Travel Pack from DefenderShield.com. Conceal Shield is cutting-edge wireless blocking technology that eliminates all signals, including EMF, GPS, and RFID. Place cell phones, credit cards, IDs, and other trackable items into the Conceal Shield, and they become totally invisible. Get Conceal Shield now at DefenderShield.com. Use promo code CONCEAL for 10% off. Guard your privacy, secure your data, and protect your health with Conceal Shield.
Are you prepared to bug out? Infidel Body Armor and an Army Ranger have produced a high-speed DVD and book to show you how to drive in combat, patrol, and how to survive in combat. Skills you'll need when it hits the fan. Go to DrivenDVD.com. DrivenDVD.com.
You've made a serious investment in protecting yourself and your family. You've purchased the gun, the ammunition, the training, and even secured a license to carry in your state. You know the Constitution and don't believe you should have to pay for a right that you already have as written in the Second Amendment, but you are law-abiding. Now you are considering the legal defense options you should have if you ever have to use a firearm. Self-Defense Fund is a comprehensive litigation membership backing you on appeals, legal expenses, court costs, and more, up to $1 million per incident and unlimited attorney costs per member. Discover SelfDefenseFund.com for yourself. Any weapon, any state, any time.
KD Armor raised the standard. Finally, AR-500 steel core body armor that comfortably conforms to the chest and torso. Unique design distributes weight, feeling lighter, increases mobility, and lessens fatigue. Introducing the Combat Quad Bend, CQB, a revolutionary plate forming process that caters to the end user. The CQB is an industry game changer, a must-have for the ladies. Available now, only at katiearmor.com, CATIarmor.com. Come and take it.
Now's your chance to get the last of the Resolution Radio Blood Tees. Only a few left available before we try to do a reorder. This has been a high-selling item, and we really appreciate everyone's support in getting this shirt and showing their pride as well as showing their heritage. Nothing counts more than blood. Get yours today from Resolution Radio. Only $25 plus $5 shipping and handling. It really helps the network improve, and you really get a great product to showcase what you truly believe in. Nothing counts more than blood. Only from Resolution Radio at ResolutionRDO.com. Send check, money order, or well-concealed cash to Sonny Thomas at P.O. Box 27, Springboro, Ohio, 45066. That's Sonny Thomas at P.O. Box 27, Springboro, Ohio, 45066.
You're listening to Resolution Radio, Radio, Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
You know, just like physical illness, mental illness can be overcome. We just got to inspire people to believe that.
The mental health community and the firearms industry spent way too much time running parallel to each other without communicating. It's time we change the narrative and destroy the stigma that we both face.
Walk the Talk America presents Guns and Mental Health, a podcast for firearms owners, clinicians, and the curious public.
Welcome
Welcome to another Guns and Mental Health podcast. We're doing a little switch up this week. I'm Kevin Berry. I'm going to jump in the host role, and we're going to interview Dr. D.B. Palmer and get a little bit more familiarized with what he does and his background. So D.B., I'll throw it over to you to give a brief bio or however you want to introduce yourself.
Yeah, sure. Well, I appreciate it. Dr. D.B. Palmer, nobody calls me that, but this illustrious crew, so I appreciate that. Every now and then it's nice to get a little nod to that, but yeah, most people call me D.B. or Hey You. Let's see, I got my start in the field probably back in 2000, 2001 in a broad sense. So definitely can talk about kind of the historical part, but yeah, a bit of what I do maybe now. So I founded 2A Mental Health. I was still in launch mode with that. So very much in the ground up movement there and getting the word out. And that was really a push, you know, from Michael Cedini and the rest of the crew at Walk the Talk. I've talked about that, you know, probably a good amount, probably will a good amount here in terms of, you know, why that and how that launched. You know, on my day to day in private practice, I see folks, you know, across six different states as a clinician, as a professional mental health counselor, depending on what state, you know, they call it different things, but basically therapists, talk to people about life, goals, dreams, stuff that's frustrating, relationships, substance things, faith, you know, the whole gamut of things that are going on across the spectrum of life. And as a private practice clinician, I practice from right here in my studio. Used to practice at my, you know, at an office space, and now practice primarily in telehealth. I've got German wire hairs decided to have a dream, right? This is little feet are kicking and he's starting to do like, hey. Anyway, hopefully it's a good dream. He sits with me through all of my sessions, which is pretty cool. He's 5 months old now. So maybe I'll get him on camera at some point, but there's no guarantee that he won't try to eat the microphone. It's still puppy zone. So, so now that I'm practicing from my studio here, at the Vineyard, which is probably the other important part to mention, you know, we are second generation, of a multi-generational, operation here, very small vineyard. Basically whenever I'm not in front of the camera here, doing telehealth, I'm out there doing something on the farm, you know, keeping that going. And that's pretty much a very short snippet of my little life here. You know, love to go a little deeper or go in different directions.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll definitely dive deeper into all the things you mentioned. Let's start. How did you first get connected to Walk the Talk America, and how did that relationship begin?
Yeah, you know, I think it was 2021 or something like that, maybe 2020, probably 2021. And the point was, I think, you know, I was aware, of course, Second Amendment concerns over the years and, you know, continued infringement of those things. And I suppose I didn't get how I was connected to that or how that directly impacted me, which of course is silly, but, it didn't really become personal, until COVID regs. I think that shift in how people dealt with each other, how, law enforcement was being pressed on all sides, how those guys and gals were all of a sudden in, you know, being clearly in a rough spot against their own, you know, governors or cities. It was just an odd switch that I thought was not, I thought the push for it would be possible, and I thought infringements would continue to happen. But how fast, as I joke, but it's not no joke. I mean, how fast things escalated. I was just blown away, and so in that process, it became clear that I wonder who else is out there, if anybody else is out there talking about mental health, talking about the Second Amendment, talking about freedom, talking about the importance of the individual and groups coming together to share their beliefs and to do that without fear of a government, of the United States government or states. I had just not considered that was a realistic thing in my lifetime. and that we would continue to hold that back. So I reached out to Google search and or something like that, and just started looking. And Walk the Talk America popped up pretty darn fast, probably right there top of the list. And I, you know, perused the site, of course, read everything that I could find, and I was blown away. I was super stoked to see that there was an agency out there. There was this push. And so after reading everything I could find on them, you know, just put out an email. I tend to work that way that, hey, if I'm interested and I really like something, I'll just reach out. You know, if they're too big and they, you know, they're going to shuffle me, you know, to the like, yeah, thanks for your interest. Then great. Cool. You know, I've reached out. I tried to see if I could learn more, but no, I mean, both Jake and Mike reached out directly, and we began a conversation. I mean, both Mike and Jake, super approachable guys. And, you know, we're clear from the start that, hey, you know, we don't know kind of what this looks like, but love that you're interested. Appreciate the, you know, the response, and we'll see if we can find something for you. Just, you know, hang tight and let's keep talking. And, you know, what a great way to respond, I thought. And from then it was pretty fast connection. You know, Jake and I get along on so many fronts, and we have a lot of kind of a really fast, witty, banter between the two of us. And, you know, I know Michael is always looking for more resources in terms of like who else is out there and how do we continue to push this conversation forward. And it was at a really good time in my own professional journey that I had left the university world. And that part of my life as a university professor, you know, was just so frenetic, so frantic around driving, trying to make connections, trying to do all this stuff. And ultimately, you know, the administrators or deans or, you know, kind of all play the politic of that. And, you know, so it takes a ton of energy to be involved in that area. And so thankfully left that and was happy to be cut free from that zone of things of kind of publish or perish. And the opportunity then to actually put my interests and energy into an effort that I could actually trust that, you know, Mike, Jake, and the rest of the crew, the board, all the other folks who were helping to volunteer would actually say, hey, yeah, bring it. Like, where do you want to go? Was just an amazing green light. So, you know, I guess long story short, I reached out, they responded, and it's been kind of thick as thieves since then.
Yeah, and it's good to have conversations like these because you've done so much work behind the scenes. I know we've worked together on the mental health survey last year that we rolled out for the first time, and a lot of other things that aren't as in the public eye. Obviously, we have the podcast that you're a part of and a little bit more public and knowledgeable, but it's good to get behind the scenes, see your journey, see who you are, and a little bit more about the people involved with Walk the Talk America. Let's maybe go to two-way mental health. I know that's kind of been a recent one and a natural shift as you've done a lot of work with Walk the Talk America, and then now you're launching this new kind of initiative and unique idea.
Yeah. I mean, you know, a big function, if not the major initial function with Walk the Talk America, was connecting mental health resources to the firearms community and trying to get those two communities to look at each other eye to eye and say, all right, how do we help each other out? Like, where do we have needs? Do you have resources in this area? And do you have need? How do we connect? And, you know, I've worked with first responders and law enforcement and military for a long, long time, former military National Guard myself, and as well as first responder, and I've worked with corrections. Anyway, so I've worked in that group in those communities for a long time. And so what I've known about that is that those groups have been making shifts. They've been recognizing that, you know, this stuff takes a toll, and that doesn't mean that that's weakness. What it means is we're humans, and just like, you know, busting your leg, that takes a little time to kind of, all right, let's work that back out and let's get back to rocking when we're set, or kind of amending things while we're, you know, staying healthy. And the same thing is true with our mental and spiritual, you know, all the other healths that we tend to divide into different categories. And so what we found initially was that the gun community was very willing to have the conversation, very willing to bring things out there and say, all right, mental health people, let's talk about how to be well. Let's talk about how to connect our seemingly, divergent communities. And what we found was that the mental health community, oddly enough, was only interested in that conversation if it was one more step away from being a gun community. Basically, we'll talk about that, but we're going to talk about taking that gun from you is really the goal in this conversation. That, maybe what's best for you in your mental health is that you're not a gun person. And that was just a non-starter. And so, well-intentioned maybe, or maybe how about maybe well-funded entities were more than happy to have the initial conversations and then start peeling things off and kind of taking things and running with them, recreating, rebranding, that kind of stuff from Walk the Talk. And, sometimes where the big pockets are, that's where the energy goes. And that doesn't necessarily mean, in fact, maybe often it doesn't mean that they've got your best intentions at heart. And so after, pushing that direction for years and years and finding out over and over that the mental health community, in large, in mass, certainly there are individuals within any community who are solid and want to do awesome stuff, really just found that that's not working. That idea of respecting other cultures and people's interests and their sense of autonomy, the kind of some of the core tenets of the mental health field of psychology and counseling, social work, medicine, that, those were cute and everything, but we really want you to like what we like. And we see a lot more of that across the field in a lot of different areas. And our area with Walk the Talk is firearm community, 2A, straight up, unapologetic. Shall not be infringed. And so, Mike mentioned, Mike Sunini mentioned to me, maybe back October, November, something like that. Maybe it's a little farther back in 23. He just said, hey, what do you think? Like, what's next? We've attempted these things. We're all busy. Like, we're all running at 100 miles an hour. Do you have any bandwidth? And, Mike knows me pretty well. And knows that I like this kind of a project. And so, I just kind of pitched it my direction and said, just tell me what you think and then we'll get behind it. And so that was my thought, was let's make sure that we separate out the function of advocacy and education, keep that on the Walk the Talk America side so that if the worst case ever happened, that the two entities are lockstep next to each other and that the service provider is functionally separate. And so that was the key push for 2A mental health, was that in this litigious society, let's make sure that an attempt at one does not crush the other. And let's then move as like two teammates down the field and start going the direction that we need to go, doing the things that we believe in. And so 2A mental health then was launched from that endeavor. And, really the key piece is, I've worked as a clinician now for, I guess, under these licenses since 2011. I've worked in the allied field at various different, lesser levels, as the clinicians would call those things, since 2001 or so. But, got the stripes and letters and stuff back in 2011. And a lot of the work that I do with people is absolutely about mental health. Straight up, this is the mental health diagnosis that we're working on. This is a major concern in a person's life. And I'm working to ameliorate or to help diminish that and to bring that back into, a gainful, solid function in that person's life. So that said, that's part of what I do. The bulk of what I'm doing is talking about, and in fact, in every case, what I'm talking about is life. I'm talking about goals, family, faith. I'm talking about how do we look at life and make life better across all these domains, and not from a focus of you are so high on this one diagnosis that everything else must stop and we can't talk about anything else. I mean, I think many clinicians would espouse that, would say what I'm saying. And yet within the medical model that we all practice, or most of us practice, you know, billing insurance and all that kind of stuff, we're just required to you know, diagnose something, treat that something, show that we treated that something. And, you know, life doesn't really work that way. So my focus with two-way mental health is to pull out of that wherever possible and to move towards a coaching model, that idea that we're addressing life domains. And since I'm licensed clinically in 6 states and still holding off on 4 others that I'd really like to pull the trigger on and send out there just because it'd be cool to be licensed in 10. I don't know why. It's a problem that I have. I'm focused on providing coaching as much as possible, skipping insurance, skipping diagnosis, not because they're not warranted, but because they're not appropriate to for those with whom I'd be having this conversation. So moving towards a coaching model, this is about life. It's about goals, about dreams. It's about the stuff that's working, stuff that's not working. And I can have those conversations with people globally, but my focus, of course, is for those in the United States, looking at specifically 2A mental health coaching.
Grab a hold of Big Breakfast flavor at Hardee's. Try 2 breakfast sliders for just $2.99. Get Applewood smoked bacon or freshly grilled sausage with fluffy eggs and golden melty cheese all on a toasty little bun. Good morning, start at Hardee's. Available now for a limited time at participating restaurants. Tax not included.
If you're a firearms owner, and especially if you carry concealed, we invite you to enroll in a membership with our partner, the United States Concealed Carry Association, at uscca.com. The USCCA is more than 700,000 Americans from every faith, political stance, and walk of life, spanning multiple demographics. They provide life-saving education and industry-leading training, some of which comes in the form of our firearms and mental health videos that we have recently produced and which will be made available to the membership over the next 12 months. We recommend that you obtain self-defense liability insurance available through Delta Defense and the USCCA so that if you find yourself in an act of lawful self-defense, you will be prepared for what happens before, during, and after that incident. With the common mission of saving lives, Walk the Talk America is proud to partner with the USCCA and Delta Defense, and we invite you to check out all they have to offer at uscca.com.
You're listening to Resolution Radio, Radio, ResolutionRDO.com.
Find your inner rebel at Dixie Republic, the world's largest Confederate store, located in Travelers Rest, South Carolina. The anti-white, anti-Christ, anti-Southern world ends at the asphalt. Welcome to God's country. Log on to DixieRepublic.com to view our Southern merchandise, from flags to t-shirts to artwork. At the store, browse through our extensive collection of belt buckles and have a custom-made leather belt handcrafted in our Johnny Reb's Gun and Leather Shop. That's DixieRepublic.com, where you can meet all of your Southern needs. While you're waiting, drop by our Confederate Corner for a free cup of coffee and good conversation. Remember, there are no strangers here, just friends who haven't met yet. Dixie Republic, we're not just a roadside attraction, we're a destination for our people. For more information, visit DixieRepublic.com.
Absolutely. I want to dive into one thing before we maybe go back to your roots and how you started as a mental health professional. But joining Mike and Jake, I get to kind of dwell behind the scenes more, which I prefer. But I've had my eyes open of a lot of experiences of mental health professionals that aren't gun owners and how they just maybe didn't understand some things, like first responders, their hesitancy to seek help because that might jeopardize their careers and their ability to provide for their family. What, since you've been more vocal about being a gun owning therapist, what's your biggest takeaway from the mental health side? And then what's your biggest takeaway as you get more into the 2A community and how they approach mental health?
Yeah, I mean, historically and to the current day, I mean, the first part is absolutely true. That there is a stigma within society at large, period, straight up, across most cultures, that seeking mental health treatment, or talking about mental health or going to counseling, you know, means that something's wrong, and either you shouldn't do that or it could jeopardize your career. And there's a reason for that second part, that it could jeopardize your career, because historically it absolutely has. And root causes, we could probably talk about that for a bit, but it absolutely has been a threat to people's career. It has ended people's careers historically, for sure, or gotten them off the line. People have not been willing to work, you know, with them or be their partner because of mental health concerns of somebody talking about maybe suicide or depression or, you know, whatever. That's certainly lesser of an issue across time. It's lesser of a concern, but it's certainly there. And so the more the mental health community can do to help, to, you know, I don't know, these phrases, it's tough. The thing about phrases is that we communicate things, you know, quickly, but then in communicating quickly, we miss nuance and we get a bit buzzy. So I'll say to destigmatize, and I don't like that I just said that, but it's important that we do destigmatize the conversation around mental health and counseling. Who of us could not use somebody to chat with about what, you know, what issues, what thoughts we're having, to have kind of a neutral third party, or at least a relatively neutral third party to talk about, you know, gosh, man, I'm really struggling in this area. What do you think? Am I nuts on this? You know, that does not mean that there's anything negative in that process. I mean, throughout all faiths, I shouldn't say that. I have not studied it in depth, all faiths, but throughout the major faith groups, counsel is a key role. It's a spiritual gift in Christianity, the gift of counsel. These are key tenets of growing up, of wising up, elevating. There are things that we're absolutely called to. So, you know, a takeaway on the mental health side is that there's a tendency to take ourselves really, really seriously and to think that we are the only source, the only provider. We are the ones who need to treat these kinds of things. And I would say that's just not true. There are great pastoral counselors. There are great coaches. And I mean like sport coaches. There are great, you know, personal trainers, great, you know, personalities who can really step up and come alongside people in times of hardship, and, you know, buddies. Now I would say each of those different folks tend to have some kind of other role in a person's life. And that's probably the unique function, of a clinical counselor or of a coach, is that really the only engagement that we have had historically with a person or patient or client in that sense is because of that clinical or counseling relationship. And that does give us a unique function in that what a person shares with me is not part of my friendship with them. And now that's got a kind of a two-part thing, but on the very, very anesthetized clinical side, what it can do for the relationship is that there's no baggage. You know, if a person shares something that's really hard, really dark, really just sad, or whatever the area of emotion or emotions, I don't follow them around the next day, and I don't bring that back up to them, you know, in 6 hours and say, remember when you told me that you were going to work on this? Like, how come you're not working on that? So that doesn't happen. They meet with me. That's in a secret and safe box. None of that comes back out. And that's powerful. And so I want to specifically mention the strength of the clinical relationship, while at the same time recognizing that I'm not doing any magic. I'm not doing surgery. That's amazing. I'm not doing surgery. I'm not doing magic. What I'm doing is having a unique relationship. And because of the role, I've had thousands upon thousands of these kinds of conversations in most every area. You know, I'll often have people say like, man, you probably haven't heard something like this. And every now and then they're right, but it's pretty rare. Usually it's the cluster of how the things fit together that are unique. You know, we're all absolutely, you know, different folks, but we live on the same planet and we all deal with the same kind of stuff in different ways. So I know I maybe went a couple different directions with that one, but
no, you're good.
I would say
I think you mentioned a big thing. I know Jake's a big proponent of wanting mental health to be treated more like physical health. We have our annual checkup that seemed normal, but mental health isn't quite there yet. I know I was an athlete growing up, and it helped having a personal trainer to help me what my body needs to prepare for competing at a high level. And then now that I'm a dad, oh, I'm carrying toddlers around. Oh, all right, let's tweak your exercises so you're putting yourself in a better spot, not hurting so much as you carry a 8-month-old and 4-year-old at times. And mental health should be the same thing. It's all a journey of life, and having a professional to kind of, hey, maybe let's tweak your routine a little, or have you thought about this, would be great. But for whatever reason, society has it such a private thing, and for so long, we just didn't talk about it. So we're at least moving in the positive direction. I want to shift a little. We're going to get to Brandon's question, which is a good path to kind of your roots. What was it that originally made you pursue mental health as a career?
Yeah. So back probably in the late 90s, I was in college. And, you know, at university, I was on the direction of being a wilderness guy. And so I was working at summer camps, working in programs like that, and doing lots of, you know, out there trips and things. And so my, you know, it was recreation management degree for my undergrad at, you know, Christian University, John Brown University in Northwest Arkansas. I had transferred there from Southern Oregon University, basically right down the road here where I met my wife. I practice and live in Southern Oregon. So I was headed very much in that direction to be a wilderness guide, to be maybe a camp director or a wilderness program director, something like that. And so I spent a number of years actually moving in that direction as a, you know, dog sled expedition guide. And, you know, that was my first big role, was working up in Ely, Minnesota, on the edge of the Boundary Waters, taking folks out on some pretty big epic trips with Paul Shirky's Wintergreen Dog Sled Lodge. Paul Shirky's a renowned polar explorer. and man, if you want to Google up somebody who's epic, Paul Shirky would be a great place to go down the rabbit hole of Arctic exploration, and what an amazing opportunity that was for me and Greta, my wife at that time, or my wife, she was my wife then and still is now. Trouble. but we weren't married back then because we got married when we were 12. Opportunity to work with him was just massive. But before one of the seasons started, you know, we were waiting for snow to fly in that sense, to get the dog teams rocking with clients. And he said, hey, I got a buddy. If you're looking for work in between, I got a buddy who does this thing called wilderness therapy or adventure therapy down in Two Harbors, Minnesota. I think it was Two Harbors at the time, not important. On, you know, North Shore Lake Superior is where their office is. And I had no idea what that meant. Like, wilderness sounded good, and therapy, I'm like, I don't really know what that is. I guess I got the word. But so, yeah, I called him up, and you know, it was the late 90s, early 2000s. So, you know, it was still phone call, and the internet existed, sure. And I think there was AOL.com and stuff, but it was very much, you know, person to person world still. And they hired me as an assistant instructor on that based on, you know, my wilderness cred. And I was basically going to shadow the lead instructor, and then we'd have an intern with us and working with, you know, 8 to 12, you know, quote unquote, troubled kids. And we'd spend 42 days in the backcountry with them, working on life, talking about tough stuff and school and parents and, you know, all the other things of that, that these, teens were, you know, button up against. And that trip, 42 days, you know, from, backpacking and mountain biking and then into the wilderness of the Boundary Waters canoeing, no buildings, just 42 days with packs and resupplies here and there. That rocked my world. That opened up the idea that, oh my goodness, I do a lot of this stuff already, working in camps and having these kinds of conversations. But to do this intentionally, to do this as a field, I just had no idea that that was a thing. So a lot of people will liken the experience to an outward bound trip or something like that, which is partially true. It's probably what people know of the most. So I tend to say, oh yeah, when they ask like Outward Bound, I say, yeah, sure. But far more clinically focused, far more intentional on the counseling and psychological side. That was the opener to me when I realized that I needed to go back to school as a guide and as a wilderness person. You know, I'm only as good as my legs and back are. And someday I'm going to get, I mean, chances are someday I'm going to get injured, or maybe I'd want to have kids because, you know, and like maybe pay for stuff, and that field pays horribly. And so I decided at that time, I'm going to keep doing this, but I kind of split back and forth. Half my year was doing expeditionary stuff with Paul Shirky and Wintergreen, doing that in the winters. And then the other half I was doing wilderness therapy, and Greta joined at that time, started doing wilderness therapy in both Minnesota and in Utah. And then we expanded that. I did grad school and then into the post-grad. My dissertation was directly on wilderness therapy. So that launched then my university career as a professor of outdoor leadership for University of Alaska, where because of that balance of the two things, both the psychological world and the outdoor leadership side of things, that stuff launched me. So it really was adventure therapy and this balance of the two worlds, working with groups, having difficult conversations while we trek across difficult terrain with next to no support, just our wits and our rapport to guide us, that really launched my career.
For almost 75 years, Strum, Ruger & Company Incorporated has been a model of corporate and community responsibility. Their motto, Arms Makers for Responsible Citizens, echoes their commitment to these principles as they work hard to deliver quality and innovative firearms. They offer consumers almost 800 variations of more than 40 product lines across both the Ruger and Marlin brands. And since 2021, Ruger has been a strong supporter of Walk the Talk America, in full alignment with this mission and philosophy. We invite you to check out Ruger.com and browse their multiple products and help support our mission along the way. Walk the Talk America thanks Ruger for its continued support of this show and our mission.
What do you find maybe is the difference between a person coming to you that's doing wilderness therapy versus maybe somebody that's joining you telehealth? Is there any big differences, big advantages, disadvantages?
Yeah. Wow. The list of differences would be all basically I'm in the room, so that's similar. I mean, for wilderness therapy, many of the programs, you know, kids are coming in, teenagers are coming in, you know, at kind of mixed decision. Maybe they were given a choice either by, if it's really a tough program, like the judge said, hey, you can go to juvie or you can do this wilderness therapy program. So that sounds like a better option for, you know, for some people. Juvie's, you know, kind of a place often where you can kind of just do some time because it kind of is that situation. Whereas maybe, you know, the wilderness therapy might be seen more as a camp opportunity, which it certainly is not. And we're pretty direct in our conversations. You know, there's some tremendous wilderness therapy programs out there. I want to really put a moment to that it's a very organized, highly ethically driven field, at least for the time that I've been in. And it's really done a lot of work to drive a solid evidence base forward. It is absolutely, based on the research and my own experience, is one of the most effective treatment modalities, period. There is just something to getting out of your own little cocoon, getting out into the wild and getting real, spending time with people who actually care, who have that clinical distance as well, and are willing to deal with life and all the challenges on a 24/7 basis across weeks. That's unheard of in the clinical world. I mean, we tend to deal in the 50-minute or 45-minute span, and then I'll see you next week, which is great. Or maybe I should say that's good. That's nice. It can be very, very productive. A person on the other side really wants to work and wants to dig in. Even if that's tough, that can be very effective. And so that's kind of balancing the telehealth side, is that, you know, when I'm doing wilderness therapy or adventure therapy, I'm not the only treatment component. I've got a world of metaphors around me. I've got experience. I've got hardship. I've got rain and cold. I've got nature. I've got, you know, all those little things that support reality, that, you know, that the world does not in any way revolve around any of us. Like, it doesn't care. Life is hard, and that is confirmed for us when we step outside the front door. And you know, if the power goes out, it's confirmed while we're still in the house. But you know, we have built these luxuries and conveniences around to shield us from things and to make life more comfortable, and that's great. Until we take those things for granted, and until we use those as crutches, and until we forget where we've come from. And so a key aspect that I'll do with most groups in the backcountry is breaking things down really, really all the way to the beginning of, let's start with friction fire. Every human on the planet historically made fire by rubbing something together and making a fire. All of us, children, adults, grandparents, we all knew that skill, and it saved us, you know, when we were cold. And oddly enough, almost none of us now can make a fire. Heck, with Matt, it's painful going to campouts and things like that with people, and like, dude, you got lighter fluid, you still can't make a fire. Like, lighter fluid, gasoline, which is, oh my goodness, don't do that. Come on, at least go with diesel or something. That simple of a thing, by teaching somebody a process that sometimes takes weeks, bloody knuckles of them smacking themselves and cursing and throwing things, that's life. And I love that about taking people into the backcountry, is that I don't have to say, hey, and nag people, nag stuff over and over. I give people like, hey, here's how I do my thing. Here's how I run my jam. You know, I give people the thing once. Unless they don't catch it, right? Unless I didn't communicate well. But I don't have to nag at a teenager or anybody else, a parent who really likes to do it their way, who hasn't actually done it at all. I don't have to say it twice. I just let nature and natural consequences take it over. And then, and I don't chuckle about it. I just, like, that is part of our learning. We are stubborn people. That's part of what makes us thrive towards things. And sometimes the best way to learn is to let natural consequences take their place. Now, sometimes that's a bear, and I step in for those occasions. I've had tons of good bear encounters and a couple that weren't so great. So I don't let natural consequences meet that out. I'll step in those cases. I don't have that situation with telehealth. There's typically no bears. Yeah, typically no bears. It's just like, you know, freezing up a screen. So
there's some curiosity in the chat about, like, Eddie's mentioned going to the range and kind of doing a therapy session while somebody's shooting. Brandon saying he's done some as well. Have you ever taken somebody on a hike to maybe get them out of that traditional office setting or Zoom setting that's not quite adventure therapy? Is that like dipping your toe in your water, or where would you put that experience?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, in fact, until the governor of Oregon decided that she would threaten us all with our licenses for what was it, gross malpractice or something, if we met with people face to face, which is a whole other conversation. I was doing, you know, walking sessions basically. So I'd meet at a trailhead, you know, billing insurance, traditional, you know, or maybe I should say contemporary counseling. And so we'd meet for 45 minutes or something like that, or whatever I was, you know, whatever the session length was. I'd have a, you know, kind of connected route, or I know those trails well enough that, okay, this person's pretty fast on the trail, then all right, I'm going to take these extra loops and we're going to end on time. And whether adults or teens, I love that. It's a great way. One of the key benefits that works on the micro level about, maybe I'll call adventure therapy, and that could absolutely be on the range therapy or hiking, is that I'm not sitting in a chair staring at you. You're sitting in a chair staring at me, and we're both wondering, what should I say now? Which, if the clinician is deft and is really practiced, you know, that awkwardness goes away over time, and they, you know, we get good at that. But I will say, you know, car rides, or where deep conversations happen, often with a parent and a kid, or with, you know, with a, in a relationship, right? And there's a reason for that. Or campfires, It's a reason why really deep conversations can happen over a campfire. And it's not just because we're not sitting and looking at each other, but it in a large way is. It's because there's this other thing happening. We're looking at the crackle, hearing the crackle, feeling the warmth. On a hike, we're looking at the trail, seeing the squirrels, and they seem like maybe simple things. But they remove that pressure of, I need to say something right now. Same with the car ride. You have this enlarged amount of time, and the focus isn't just two people staring at each other and wondering what to say next. It can unfold more naturally, but it's still a bit of a contained environment. And that's what I think is one of the key, you know, I guess I'd say drivers of the process, whether it's on the range, campfire, or any of those other things. The other key piece is that you're in a metaphor building scenario. So you can be connecting physical things to spiritual or psychological or relational things. And there's a reason, you know, why the Bible, why other, you know, great texts connect to metaphors, because what we get that we can internalize those things.
Ghost was interested in kind of the political restraints. Obviously, we could probably have a whole podcast on your thoughts on that, but dive into how that's maybe decided some decisions. Maybe it was around building two-way mental health or some other things, just like you talked about. What factors in the last couple of years have made you make decisions that otherwise maybe wouldn't have been made without the political restraints?
Yeah, gosh, you're right. It could absolutely be a whole show or four. You know, the field of psychology, counseling, social work, very much in their beginning stages and for decades after, were about I'll jump to social work for just a moment. Social work was an activist movement rebelling against the medical kind of overbearingness, and that was an idea that they were basically like, hey, we're going to help people. This isn't about, you know, billing and all of your control. And they were powerhouses back in the 60s towards, you know, like actually digging into people's lives, finding other resources and connecting things. And I won't go any further on where social work has gone. I'll pivot now. So then if we look at psychology and counseling fields, we've come to a place where what is politically correct is now what we are demanded to do ethically. And that's an interesting thing, because not all of our clients, not all of our patients agree with whatever political thing is de rigueur or in fashion right now. But we are commanded from on high, oddly enough, from a governmental agency, effectively. Our counseling boards, our psychological boards, are in most states directly staffed by the governor, or staffed and then voted in by the remaining folks for the remaining chairs. So they are governmental boards. That's antithetical entirely to the freedom and aloofness that we ought to be operating from, and that our original ethics all derived from. All of us began philosophically, each of our fields, from a removal from any kind of governmental oversight. This was about the clinician of whatever their title is, and the individual, the patient, client, person, and looking at their life, their trajectory, and being able to challenge and support that person. And we are directly barred from challenging certain things that have become unfashionable, and we are commanded to support other things which have become in the same things, fashionable, at the threat of our careers, our licenses, and maybe more. That is baffling to me, how our field ultimately agreed to that. All we had to do was say no, kind of like the last couple of years. All we really had to do was just say no. But most of us don't want to, you know, we think it's going to get better and it's not really going to be that bad. And if I'm the one that steps out, I'm going to get picked off. And well, that's true. If you are the one who steps out in front of everybody else and the rest of everybody else stays back, that's how these things continue to erode. And I don't mean any kind of, you know, any mal intent in my mention of stepping forward. What I mean is stepping forward and speaking truth. No, this isn't, we're not going to do that. We appreciate your interest in that. And thank you. No. And I think we have become so tentative for decades of allowing what we might call a political, well, no, what we did call a PC culture, that just, it didn't really affect us. There weren't really any direct, most of us didn't know somebody directly who got taken out by that. And so we all kind of let that go. And it was just annoying. And then it got more annoying. And then we started to see people taken out by it. And then we became concerned that it could be us. And that's a slow walking. And that's how that works. I think it was Jordan Peterson was saying, basically, they're going to, what people do is they'll push up to a line until you say stop. And then they'll stop. They'll back off for a moment. They'll take a step backwards. And then everybody kind of eases up. And then they'll push a little further. And then, you know, over the course of, let's say, you know, 4 years, you'll find that if you actually could take a moment and pause and look at where you are now, it's far from where you began, far from where you already said no. You're well across that line. So in the political realm, there are a tremendous amount of things that clinicians are hamstringed by or commanded to do that would never have been the case previously.
And it seems confusing for kind of the end consumer, the average public. I've noticed some professionals are using more the word coaching, and then their bio shows all their credentials. They're legitimate. And okay, so there's some mental health coaches that maybe don't have those credentials of someone maybe like you that's trying to avoid some licensing board coming down on them. And then it makes it difficult to kind of navigate for the consumer and hurts them just because all these professionals are worried about licensing board coming out after their license and ruining their world. So it's really unfortunate to see recently. I know there's been a lot of talks of, ooh, that could be a shift just to prevent something that could happen. Or if he comes for sharing some opinions and licensing boards don't agree with it, they come after him. And it's unfortunate. It's not as transparency, and mental health already has a hard enough time in the field finding a therapist that's right for you and who should I go to? Who do I trust? Kind of opening up to. It doesn't need any more veils and things to try to sift through as the end user and average day person.
Well, I mean, you bring up an important point in that, and that's that the diagnosis and mental health diagnosis side of things is not the origin of the field. And yes, we discuss you know, categorically what we're addressing. And so categorically, like in anything else, if we're on the range and we recognize, okay, I have a tendency, for example, to yank left as I pull a trigger. Well, I need to diagnose that. I need to like, okay, what's my first thing that I need to start dealing with? So I need to be able to break that down. And I'm not just going to say, well, let's just talk about life and let's talk about your feelings about that. Or, you know, let's talk about, you know, your relationships, and that'll improve your aim. And maybe, but probably I need to take a clinical look at what are the operational functions that aren't going well and how do we improve those? And we could call that a diagnosis, but in truth, it's this whole range of stuff. And so I would say that the field of psychology, counseling, social work, that and to a lesser extent, psychiatry, medicine, because they tend to avoid the talk part of this, have really been hemmed towards the diagnostic model, that the disorder, maybe that's the word I should use more than diagnosis. I think disorder is probably where I'm actually speaking here, is that we've focused so much on disorder rather than understanding clinically what is what we're looking at and how do we improve that. And so we've gotten to this disorder as if it's a disease model, when we've debunked that over and over, and yet it's still there. We've looked at the research over time that's, you know, been, for example, funded heavily by pharma, and like for 3 decades, like that became the medical model of this particular disorder. And because because the research says so. And we all knew that who funded that. We're like, yeah, but the data looks pretty good. But now we look at that, some of those same data, and we recognize this was flawed from the start. This was absolutely, absolutely incorrect. And a lot of us knew it at the time. But for the bulk of us, like, once again, do you want to stand out? Do you want to be the person that says that? And so we allowed that to move in that direction towards disorder, disease. Gosh, I mean, we talk about disorder and disease as in mental health as if it's incurable. And yet cancer will straight up kill you, right? It's also sometimes curable. And so we look at cancer very differently than we do depression or bipolar or something like that. We somehow, bipolar or depression is deadlier or a longer term sentence than cancer. And I find that I just don't understand the logic there. Cancer will or may straight up kill you, and it may actually be curable. Like, we don't know. So we do our level best when we're talking about cancer. And with depression, we're like, well, you know, it's genetic. You're going to have this forever. So good luck. I mean, not really good luck. Just, you're going to be depressed forever, but just keep taking our pill. And so go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, it almost seems financially incentivized of to get maybe treatment or this, you have to be suffering from this instead of just, hey, let's talk about things. And maybe we treat the underlying cause and don't have to slap that hard label of a strong diagnosis, which seems to be so, like you say, negative. It's, oh, I have this, and it's not, ooh, I have whatever, some good thing. Everybody, it's a very negative thing. And in order to get treatment, or maybe people are looking for some medication or something to help them, they have to get diagnosed, you have that, so then we can treat it, instead of, oh, I have a sprained ankle, let's try to strengthen your ligaments, and you're not going to have a sprained ankle forever. Let's just treat it, and then it goes away. But with mental health, it's, we need to label it as this to then treat it.
Among Walk the Talk America's partners, Arms Corps may have the most colorful history of them all, but then again, that likely happens when you have a company that's lasted for more than a century. Started in 1905 in the Philippines and expanding operations to right here to Nevada in 1985, Arms Corps offers some of the finest firearms you'll find on the market, from shotguns to 1911s, and from ammunition to a competitive shooting team, Arms Corps offers a lot. But there's something more. Arms Corps is the first manufacturer to print the free and anonymous mental health screenings link offered through Walk the Talk America's website right there on their packaging. If you buy an Arms Corps product, you will not only see our flyer inside, but you may actually see the screenings link printed on the side of the box. Go to armscor.com, that's armscor.com, to find out more about their heritage, their products, and their competitive shooting team. We're proud and thankful to have Arms Corps as a partner.
Yeah, and the direction of 2A mental health coaching really is not one. And so this is an area where I think that boards would love to see, a slip or a sliver in here would be that, well, okay, you're using the coaching thing to circumvent, the licensing in a certain state. Like, no, I love getting licensed in different states. That's a fun process of navigating every state's idea that they have the best licensing rules. I find it kind of oddly, certainly entertaining, but kind of oddly fun, to deal with that, out of the silliness. But what I'm saying in that is that, no, actually, the clinical skills that a person gains from a really good, from really good training are really, really important. So I think that the training that I've received and that many others have received from great supervisors, from great clinicians, in terms of how to have these difficult conversations, I think that's gold. I think that's something that I would be concerned that people just decide, well, I want to be a coach. Like, all right, so any coach has got training. They've got tremendous experience in any other field, right? If you're a basketball coach, like, you play basketball, you worked with other coaches, you were an assistant coach, you had probably decades before you took that title coach, because you understand the nuances and how to motivate people, how to have those tough conversations, how to work on those skills and techniques, and then the psychology as well, the sports psych of what a basketball player is thinking in this position versus that position. So that's not That's not just, I like basketball, I want to be a basketball coach. That's training and a ton of time. And your own coaching along the way as well. And so that's the piece that I think that for the mental health coach, super important. This is my bias. Super important that you are really, really clinically trained, that you have gotten a tremendous amount from the OG books in the field, I've got, you can't probably see it, it's one of the middle ones, where you are like steeped in the history and in the origins and the progression of the field and in the practice within the field, and that we are not so arrogant as to believe that that everything is a disorder, everything is a disease, and that I, as a clinician, am not, and that's the interesting part, that I'm not held to actually being a part of a person's, what we might call, recovery. Because I would say, no, absolutely I am. I'm on the hook when a person signs up with me, in my view, that if this person does not make improvements, and I just say, well, you know, you're depressed, so we'll just talk every week about how's your medication going, which may not necessarily be a negative step. So I don't want to put that out there. But it may not necessarily be a great step either. But if my role is really just to do med management, there are other people who have that title. And if I'm not holding myself to the standard of, this person came in with this concern, how are they doing with that? Can we as a team get to the next step? And that does not mean that a person won't be depressed with some stuff again in the future, because life is kind of depressing. So we work on tools, we work on skills, and we have the hard conversations, hopefully before stuff gets difficult. But at a last point, hopefully when we recognize it, oh, crap, like, yeah, I'm at it again. Let's talk, Doc.
Ghost had a question on kind of the licensing of different states, and then he also has a really good question there I think is going to make for a good conversation. So quickly address, do states reciprocate with licensing from other states, or are they all kind of separate when getting licensed in different states?
Yeah, if you ask the states, some states will say that they have a reciprocity license. The truth of it is no, absolutely not. Some states are just worse than others in reciprocity. So some states have we have no reciprocity. So you've got to go through their entire process. And sometimes that means going through supervision, initial supervision again, from 0 hours all the way through whatever they decided what was the appropriate amount of hours. Other states have a far smoother process, but you still have to jump through their individual hoops in the process. I would say, in case anybody from Utah Board of Licensing is listening, Utah so far is the best. Like, they understand that there's an internet, first of all. They use the internet, they use forms, they use things that, you know, I think I was licensed in Utah within days because they use the available technology that's out there rather than some kind of like fax machine phone calls. And like, it's so insane the level of, anyway, I think most of us are aware of this when we work with big government agencies. They're maybe 3 decades behind, you know, our current technology. Utah is pretty close. So that's a short answer. No, there's no true reciprocity, but there are certainly worse places.
All right. This next one's going to be interesting because Ghost is asking, has social media helped or hindered the mental health landscape? And I think this is interesting because both you can answer it as a mental health professional, and then I work with social media, so we can kind of compare notes after the end. But you go first.
Oh, man. This one's fraught. Social media is a place where anybody around the world can go with whatever interest they have and find 50,000 at minimum other people who are interested in that same thing. And now there are places where that's tremendously beneficial. Gosh, I found, you know, so many people who are interested in, you know, canoeing and ultra racing that I would never have met without social media. It was an expander and a connector in so many ways. It's also a place where people talk about, oh, you know, my OCD, you know, da da da, and we have it. Never-ending memes on how, you know, what OCD is from somebody who just says that they have OCD, and then tells everybody else what OCD is. And then, you know, oddly enough, lots of people have OCD according to the meme factory. And from a clinical perspective, like that's not OCD. OCD is like, it's legit and it's uncomfortable. It is unpleasant. And I don't mean you feel unpleasant. I mean, there are diagnostic criteria required. I'm just saying OCD because that's a very common phrase that I hear used in the public conversation. Like, oh, my OCD won't let me do this. Like, no, actually, if you had OCD, it wouldn't be something as cute as that. And it would be debilitating, almost debilitating. And it absolutely can be worked through. It's not something cute that we pet. And I think that's one of the concerns one of the major ones that I have with the social mediaization of the mental health side of things, that we make things cute pets that we really ought to recognize if they are in our lives. Those are concerns. They're not cute. The best course is to hold them in front of ourselves and say, okay, how do I deal with this? I think the idea is that by sharing it with others, we destigmatize it. And I'm not seeing that as the actual outcome. I'm seeing it. What we do is we grow it. We expand it and we make it cute in that sense. And that's the interesting thing, because then the charge would be, well, now you're making a stigma of that thing. Now see, you're doing exactly what you're saying that you don't want. You don't want a mental health stigma. Now, I'm saying I want us to recognize the challenges that are in front of us and address them and not to play with them. I don't think that they're cute. I don't think that they're fuzzy. I think they can be debilitating, and I absolutely don't want to foster that in somebody else's life. I think the power of words is incredibly important. I referenced Chad Wright, former Navy SEAL, often. He was on the Rick Roll podcast years ago, and he was talking about the very topic of the power of words, the spoken word, and that when we speak that thing, we create a reality. And so he focuses in his ultra races on only saying something that's helpful. Like, an ultra race sucks. We all know this, even if we've never done one. To run 100 miles will be painful. Nobody gets through that without a tremendous amount of pain. But what utility is it to tell your running crew, like, oh, this sucks, I'm really working through this. Like, no, that we all then start to think about how that stinks for us. Yes, it's honest, but is it helpful? And that'd be my question to the social media part of things, is there are absolutely aspects of social media that I think are helpful. But like any psychotropic drug, we got to take that thing with tremendous seriousness and use it for the purpose that it's beneficial for, and recognize as we now know, it comes with serious potential side effects. Kevin, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think you bring up a good point of, it's almost an overcorrection of society of, we didn't talk about mental health for so long, and now on social media, maybe we're talking about it too much or in ways that aren't maybe appropriate when seen in a professional's like your eyes. And it's hard to sift through. There's so many people that want to talk a good game and sound like they know what they're doing, but it can be dangerous with healthcare. If we see nutritionists maybe that are really well-spoken and they get a lot of followers, so they seem legitimate, but you don't really know if they're legitimate to follow what they're advising to eat, or even pills or prescription supplements. Same with mental health. But you're right. It also has its positives with Jake and you and other professionals being able to get your information out there. I just wish there was a better way to kind of almost show credentials. We talk about the dangers of licensing boards, so we know it's a fine line, but it would be nice to say, hey, this person's verified. Here's what they submitted in their verification process or something. Obviously, that takes a lot of work on the platforms, and they probably don't really have the appetite for it, and it can go bad in so many ways. But it would just be nice to help the users see, oh, this person's legit, because I can see they have this amount of education, this credential, not the education's the end all be all, but help people find a way through the people that are talking a good game and just kind of gaming the algorithms, getting engagement to reach more people, and the people that actually know what they're talking about and can actually help you. But yeah, it's an interesting thing as we watch it evolve into, going from not really talked about at all, very private conversations, maybe on a hike you get into in-depth conversations, to now social media, everybody's talking about things. And maybe it goes a little bit too far where people are playing, maybe victimizing themselves to get attention on social media. It has a lot of drawbacks and positives that you have to kind of wade through and try to filter through.
Absolutely. You know, we used to poke fun at the kind of, when you'd use Wikipedia as a reference, for example, in any kind of conversation, right? Like, oh, well, you know, I learned on Wikipedia that, well, what we kind of know is that's people populated. And yeah, it's vetted by other folks, but you know, we kind of learned early on, I'm thinking of grading papers, for example, which I still teach a course here and there just to stay in touch with that. And, you know, so for example, if somebody cites Wikipedia as a source, I try to remind them, straight up remind them, like, let's find an academic journal, a peer-reviewed something, you know, that is, well, that's peer-reviewed, something that is vetted, something that is academically sound. It doesn't, once again, that doesn't mean it's going to be a great source, but Wikipedia is absolutely not going to be a great source. And the internet is effectively just Wikipedia with faces, right? I mean, so when we don't vet the credentials of the person, or when we just utilize kind of the sounding board of Wikipedia, that we like this face and I agree with what they're saying, and so therefore it's true, that's a serious problem in our media literacy. And that is the role of parents primarily, and then whatever educational environment secondarily. But it's our role as parents, educators, as guardians, as guides, to invest time into our youth and, of course, into ourselves from the beginning, and to stay on that. And I think that's probably where I'm going to go with, you know, how do we deal with this? Well, parents have got to step up and have these conversations with their kids. They need to know their kids well and be thoroughly engaged in every aspect of their lives from a loving and caring and supportive perspective. And sometimes that means calling the kid on the carpet. But if you know your kid and you've spent that time prior, that's not an ugly thing. That's a thing that you have built that relationship. And if you haven't, we can talk about how to deal with that too. But it's probably not just from some kind of brusque, you know, thing. It's going to be about owning that you didn't put in the time earlier, being responsible for that, and then doing the work to rebuild or to build what hasn't been built. So we can, and we do tend to do this, right? We tend to look at things that we don't like, things that may well legit be problems. And we tend to forget that we have some role in that. And we have some role. I didn't speak up enough about PC culture decades ago. It didn't hit me. And I didn't speak up enough about it. That impacted who knows how many people that I didn't say something, and who, maybe they wouldn't have cared, but some weird dude said something counter to that. That could have been me. And that would have planted one more kernel in that seed that maybe some of this is a little bit bonkers, or maybe it's not legit. So I do want to put that out there, is that we tend to look at the other and pull away or polarize from that. And in almost every scenario, we have some part in it. Maybe it's small, and maybe it's a little late, but each of us are responsible on so many levels. Maybe that's a whole other conversation. Responsibility.
Eddie has a fun question. I'm gonna tweak it a little bit. He said you and him have never shot together, and he wanted to rank you and who would be the better shooter. But I'm gonna make it a little harder on you. Between
Eddie, obviously.
Between the gun-owning mental health professionals that kind of host the show, so you, Jake, Brandon, and Eddie, please rank them in order of who you think would be the best shooter and who you're kind of throw under the bus in the last spot.
We want to take a moment to recognize one of our sponsors, Chattanooga Shooting Supplies, Inc. CSSI was founded in 1977 by two families that had a passion for hunting and the outdoors. That same passion holds true today for the second generation of family members and their 200-plus employees. Own a gun store or range? If so, you understand the importance of two-step distribution to help you meet the demand of your customers. Their mission is to exceed their customers' expectations with a strong service focus from a knowledgeable sales staff, an assortment of trusted and well-known brands, competitive pricing, and timely shipping. With over 50,000 SKUs of shooting and hunting related products, they are in the business to help customers succeed. Learn more at ChattanoogaShooting.com.
Oh, cripes. Eddie, oh, man. well, it's better than what Eddie said he was going to be putting into the comments. So I appreciate that. And this one just alienates me from my actual friends in the crew here. So in the manner of being a constant diplomat, maybe a recovering diplomat. I mean, Eddie is a professional shooter. I would imagine he's a pretty good shot. He's headed to Italy to represent the U.S. in black powder and a range of things that I barely even understand. First of all, and then he's actually legit good at that, sponsored. So Eddie takes number one. Probably. I have a hard time just. Eddie takes number one on that particular podium, and maybe on all of them. That skill is so. I mean, he's fire. Anyway, if you check out,
if you're not shooting the musket, he might drop down to fourth. I don't know. He's good at black powder, but
yeah. But he's shooting at distance with that heavy rifle, or I guess it's a gun technically. So I'll assume Eddie's got serious transferable cred across multiple platforms. I know Brandon shoots a lot as well. At least that's my understanding. That's what he tells me. Is shooting a good amount. I've had a good amount of experience in shooting, and I know that Jake is, I think, kind of younger on the shooting side. But that said, I know Jake shoots a fair amount. And Jake's a bigger dude, so I'm probably not going to piss him off in this and rank myself above Jake. So. Like as Jake will tell you, he's built like a linebacker. So 250 built like a linebacker, or 220.
Maybe more of a free safety, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, according to Jake, Eddie top. I think Brandon's probably right up there. I think Jake and I will probably be head to head. Although, Jake and I will probably just get distracted and talking about something, and we probably forget that the targets are moving, and so. I know I totally dismissed giving any stepping out on that one, but nice try, Eddie. Yeah.
Ghost had one more question before we maybe and go to wrap things up. But obviously, religion's a big part of your life. How is it for you treating people who are very religious, maybe in a religion that's similar to yours, religious in a religion that's different than yours, and not religious at all?
Oh, yeah. I think most of my most of my conversations are with people who do not espouse, my religion, Christianity, or are in a different area of my faith. And so whether it be LDS or Catholic. And so they're close aspects in those. And so I would say that might be kind of in that middle ground, but I'll stick maybe with those who are very religious. There's a great quote by, Christian theologian and philosopher Paul Tillich, and I won't try to directly quote, but it basically says, I think part of my role is to bring doubt to the faithful and faith to the doubtful. And that's not saying my job here is to change your mind. My role in so many of my conversations is to have you honestly ask questions, not to shake a person's faith, nor to require that somebody who doesn't have a particular or my particular, faith have my particular faith, but to hold the mirror up and to honestly ask those questions that we each do ask at some point in our lives. Why am I here? What's meaningful? I ask that as the penultimate question, to every one of my intakes. What makes life meaningful? How do you know that you're on the path, or when you're on the path and when you aren't? And for me, that's gauging worldview. And often the answer is, I don't know. That's why I'm here, or I've been working on that, or I know an answer, but I don't really live the answer. And that's across people of faith, people of different faith, people of no ascribed faith. my role in this relationship with people is to see them move forward and to answer and to try to answer questions as honestly as they possibly can. Now, my bias in this, I would hope, because I mean, I chose, that's a great theological thing. I'll avoid the maybe Calvinist versus non-Calvinist side of Christianity for the moment. But I'll say, I believe in what I believe because I believe it to be true. Now, so the bias would be, it wouldn't be great if everybody thought that. Sure. I also well aware that that's not going to happen. That's very unlikely that that's going to happen. And it's certainly not my role, within my power to convince someone that it must be what they believe. What I want to see is people authentically owning their decisions and moving in that direction. By my faith, I would say that if they can do that, I think that will lead them to the truth that I believe. And maybe it won't. Maybe that is an incorrect assumption. But I'm humble enough to recognize that I don't control that, and that may not be their direction.
You made it through an hour and 10 minutes. We got two questions left. You're doing good. Since joining Walk the Talk America and being active over the last couple of years, what is the biggest takeaway and what's been the biggest change in your life?
You know, I think the biggest takeaway, gosh, I mean, I'm glad I'm not reading the comments in the chat. It just helps to not be distracted in that. So appreciate everybody in the comments. Continue to write them because I know Kevin is paying close attention to that. So, you know, I think the biggest change, and what was almost made it through.
Since joining Walk the Talk America over the years, what's been either your biggest takeaway or change in your life?
Yeah. Takeaway has been that the firearms community is really doing a lot to reckon with suicide, with the greater mental health side of things, relationships, family, really doing a lot to recognize that we're all in a messy spot of life, and not the 2A community, just all of us. We're all in a tough, life is difficult, and the 2A community is working, from my perspective, from what I've seen, to balance this role of responsibility and freedom, and that the Second Amendment is exactly that. It is a freedom that balances against our responsibility. And not that if we're not responsible, we don't get that. Well, it kind of depends on how we have that conversation. But the more responsible that we are, the more free we are. The more we take ownership of our own lives, the more that we take ownership of our family and our choices, the more freedom that affords. And the Second Amendment is a stopgap in that sense, to maintain that on a societal level, that we have this buffer against tyranny in a physical sense. But I think that transcends really to what I've experienced in people's personal lives, is the more that people recognize that, and they may be coming in because they like guns or they grew up shooting, but the more they get into the community, what I've found is the more they recognize the other aspects of life. Am I taking responsibility for my physical health? Am I taking responsibility for my relationships, for my marriage, for the relationship with my kids, me as a coworker, or as a business owner? It's interesting when I look at people who disparage the 2A community, for example, for this reason or that, or they're all this, and then I kind of look at kind of two general, kind of avatars of the two different groups. What I find is a group on the 2A side that typically is working on improvement and owning up to stuff and taking responsibility, and those who tend to be lobbying against that, I don't necessarily find that as frequently. That means a lot to me, that, you know, if we disagree, that's fine. And if in our disagreement, what I discover is that, man, you're really working on your life. You're working on stuff and you're working on family and you're building relationships and you're starting from yourself. Then I really take a hard look at, like, man, where am I going wrong in this disagreement with this person? Because what I'm seeing as fruit in their lives is beneficial. And that doesn't come from nowhere. when that's not the case, then often it just looks like, well, I want you to change and do something, but I don't want to have to do anything myself. And that's just not what I've seen in the 2A community at large. So I think the biggest takeaway is that most of us have been taught, if we haven't been much in the 2A community, that these are just gun-toting, you know, right-wingers, and they just like, you know, being authoritarians and all this stuff. And I haven't experienced these people. I came from a pretty hippie background. You know, I did, you know, grad and post-grad stuff. I was a backpacker, still am. You know, I sing, you know, as an opera chorus member. Like I would have thought that the 2A community would look pretty sideways at a guy like me. And what I found was, oh, we have a ton in common. And I think I'm part of the community. There's a ton of grace. There's a ton of openness within the 2A community that I just have not experienced in other places. So that'd be my takeaway is, man, if you think these things about the 2A community, I'd strongly encourage you to go and ask questions, ask them honestly and with some humility, and you may be really, really surprised at how welcoming this bunch of weirdos is.
All right, forget Mike's last question about how you stay mentally healthy. What's here you sing?
Oh, yeah.
All right, we won't put you on the start. All right. How do you stay mentally healthy as someone that works in the field?
You know, a big thing is I really like to shoot. I try to go to a course each month to meet with other people who like to shoot, whether it's tactical or other aspects of it. Had a great opportunity. I want to do this shot. I had a great, like we had Will Chesney on the show recently. I think it was last week. Time flies. I had a great opportunity to go shoot with him prior to that and with a bunch of law enforcement guys and gals, and SWAT team folks. And what an amazing opportunity to just get out, get active, get it out. The other key thing that I do for mental health, for my own spiritual total health, is typically either at the beginning of each day, I try to do it at the end, which isn't normally my preference, but it seems to be better treatment, is at the end of each day after my sessions, I head straight to the gym or something physical. It's my decompression from those honest and difficult conversations. My family is super important to me. The farm, we are actively engaged with, you know, farm animals and growing things here. That's all really important to me to shake it up. Our kids are really, really important in our lives. And I don't mean like, cause they're important in all of our lives. And so, I mean, for what that means for us is, you know, we really try to get to know, and be part of fostering experiences for them, be really hands-on with that, and then balance the tough part of when they actually kind of get some wings and start going in those directions without us. And, and our church is fantastic. I've been a cantankerous person most of my life, and always, you know, it's easy to find fault. And I guess I thought that was a skill. And I just so encouraged by the church that we're currently in and being part of the, you know, Reformed, you know, church. So encouraged by people who are looking at life and willing to ask tough questions. One of the main ones is, why are men leaving the church? And why have we for the last three decades? Well, it's 'cause it sucked for the last three decades. And we've been weak and we've been irresponsible. And so I'm so privileged, or honored to be a part of, you know, of this group that is saying, you know, maybe we should point the fingers at ourselves in this, and maybe we should, you know, put our shoulder to the wheel. So that's all part of it. And dogs are good too.
Well, thank you, DB, for kind of joining and doing this solo interview so people can learn more about you and how you think and where you come from and all the things, and diving into kind of therapy. I know we had a lot of good questions in the chat. Thanks everybody for joining in there as I had to run my first one as host, as a live stream operator, and trying to be mindful of the chat. And thank you for all our sponsors who make these conversations possible. And as Jake would say, we wish you all great mental wellness. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Resolution Radio, Radio, Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
This is the Justice Report weekly recap for March 24th to 30th, 2024. Today's story. Patriotic Alternative demonstrates for release of political prisoner Sam Melia. Leeds, United Kingdom. The pro-white nationalist organization Patriotic Alternative marched to demand the release of political prisoner Sam Melia on Saturday. The protest would be their largest demonstration to date and comes amid a surge of UK thought crime convictions, which have since gained international attention. The march, which included PA leaders Mark Collett and Laura Towler, was conducted in Leeds City Centre, drawing dozens of attendees from across the UK. The demonstration eventually made its way to Leeds Civic Hall in Millennium Square, where the group distributed leaflets and gave speeches in front of a busy crowd. Yesterday, Patriotic Alternative held our largest flash demo to date, read a statement on PA's official Telegram page. Attention was drawn to the draconian laws that the anti-white state uses to unfairly target patriotic people. This is just the beginning. We will continue campaigning for a stop to the political persecution of nationalists. It continued.
Today's story. Middle schoolers are charged with anti-Semitic hate crimes. Calvert, Maryland. Three middle schoolers have been criminally charged over an alleged incident involving anti-Semitic harassment. The suspects, all of whom are only 13 years old, now face hate crime violations in the latest push to prosecute children for hate speech in the United States. According to the Calvert County State's attorney, three young students at Plum Point Middle School in Southern Maryland have been charged with hate crimes in connection to the harassment of a fellow Jewish student. The 13-year-old suspects are alleged to have displayed swastikas, made Nazi salutes, and directed offensive comments to a classmate because of the classmate's religious beliefs, according to prosecutors. All three of the accused were not identified due to their status as minors, and the alleged comments were not explained further. According to the Office of the State's Prosecutor, Robert Harvey, the alleged harassment began in December of 2023. The unidentified victim is then said to have contacted the state police, who filed charges after an investigation determined the accused had been asked numerous times to stop. The Maryland Department of Juvenile Services is now reviewing the case. It's frankly astonishing that nearly 400 years later, some people continue to persecute others based upon their religion, said Harvey in a request for comment by the Washington Post. Religious persecution has no place in our society. While neoliberal repression would manifest itself very quickly in defense of Jewish students at Plum Point, the same could not be said about white students in similar situations. In 2023, white students of Kenwood Elementary School in Springfield, Ohio, were forced to support Black Lives Matter by a gang of black students. A video of the humiliating incident was later released to the Justice Report through a Freedom of Information Act request, where it quickly went viral.
Today's story. A mixed-race gang is charged for the beating death of a homeless white man. Stevens Point, Wisconsin. A homeless white man who fell victim to a brutal assault by a multi-ethnic gang has now died, the Justice Report has learned. A criminal complaint tied to the incident asserts the beating was launched after the man tried to stop the group from stealing items out of unlocked cars. According to reports, 61-year-old Donald G. Mitchell Jr. was found face down on the concrete in City Parking Lot 16 after sustaining a violent attack by up to three men. Mitchell, who is believed to be living in a camper attached to his car, was transported by an ambulance to a local hospital for treatment. Due to a significant brain bleed, however, he was flown via helicopter to a different facility. The next afternoon, Mitchell died from his injuries, with doctors noting that every bone in his face had been fractured, along with several ribs. For the crime, police arrested three men aged 18 to 20 who were in the area after having been denied access to a local bar. A criminal complaint tied to the incident asserts that 18-year-old Christian J. Emerson, 19-year-old Arlen O. Sangster,
and 20-year-old Brandon L. Bame had beaten Mitchell after he confronted them stealing items out of unlocked cars. The document alleges that after Mitchell had caught them rummaging through his truck, he asked them, "What are you doing in my truck? What did you take from my truck?" An eyewitness said she heard one of the men reply, "You got three big guys coming up on you. You want to mess with us?" Witnesses state that all three men had then begun to repeatedly punch Mitchell until he fell to the ground. Then, they were alleged to have kicked and even stomped the 61-year-old in the head, causing the worst injuries. For more news like this, visit justicereport.news and subscribe to our Telegram, Substack, and Odyssey to keep up to date on all the latest headlines from around the world. Become a paid supporter and gain access to our full archive of audio articles. And enjoy the Justice Report on the go.
I meant what I fucking said. Now I got a bunch of people asking me, "Oh, what are we gonna do? What should we do?" Educate yourself. Spread the word. The United Nations has just declared war on the truth. They're telling you outright, if you speak up, you're a conspiracy theorist. Shouldn't be believed. Should be approached in a certain fashion. The authorities should be contacted and all kinds of neat shit. If they want war, arm yourself with facts. Get out there and start telling the people. You don't want to do it on social media? Do it in person. Do it on the telephone. Do it like we used to do, standing around on the street corner having a coffee. Do you know who your enemy is? The World Economic Forum. 51 years they've been working at this. They've been planning and scheming, working as hard as they can. And now, here we are. Klaus Schwab has admitted that for over 45 years, they've been working directly with the CCP. Now here we are in Canada and the U.S. We got 5G, military-grade 5G technology right across the country. Where did it come from? Who owns that technology? And what's going to happen when they don't like us anymore? Get to know your enemy. Get to know the facts. Speak the fuck up. Be a warrior. That's what we need to do, instead of following Marcus like a bunch of fucking sheep.
Iodine is naturally acquired through the soil, which is at the foundation of our entire food supply. Modern farming techniques have stripped the soil of this essential trace element, which has caused an iodine deficiency in about half the population. And there are two things we need to do about it. We need to practice more regenerative farming. There are plenty of proven technologies in permaculture and biodynamics that will naturally keep the soil rich with iodine. And we need to ensure that we get the sufficient amount of iodine every day. Derived from ancient sea salts found thousands of feet below the Earth's surface, our InfoWars Life Survival Shield X3 is hands down the best. Pure nascent iodine, stabilized in an activated tri-iodine form. For a healthy thyroid and a healthy metabolism, get yours now at InfoWarsStore.com.
Family, this is James Edwards, your host of the Political Cesspool. Folks, I want you to subscribe to the American Free Press, America's last real newspaper. Against all odds, AFP has and continues to publish a populist, independent print newspaper with an unparalleled track record. Founded by a dedicated group of experienced patriots, AFP pulls no punches and tackles the most controversial and pressing issues facing America from an America First perspective. I've worked with the American Free Press since even before the beginning of TPC. Now that's something. You can subscribe to the print edition by visiting AmericanFreePress.net today, or simply pick up a handy digital edition subscription. However you do it, subscribe to the American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, by visiting AmericanFreePress.net or by calling 1-888-699-NEWS, AmericanFreePress.net.
There are many water filters to choose from, but there is only one system that is consistently customer rated 5 stars as the number one system for effective filtration of fluoride, radiation, drug residues, heavy metals, a wide range of radioisotopes, and more. Introducing the PureFect Ultra, the next generation water filter that also raises alkaline pH, improves antioxidant potential, and has advanced anti-radiation technology, all while using no electricity. Sold worldwide, it provides virtually instant clean water on demand. It is not made in China, and the shipping is free to all 50 states. Buy your PureFect Ultra today by visiting PureFectFilters.com or call 888-891-4821. Again, that's 888-891-4821 or visit PureFectFilters.com.
By now you know that wireless technology like cell phones do in fact pose dangers to the health and privacy of everyone. Blockit Pocket's wide range of products are unmatched in providing the protection you deserve. No scare tactics, just common sense. BlockitPocket.com offers quality American-made options to alleviate and eliminate these invisible dangers. Learn more at BlockitPocket.com or call 888-315-9618. BlockitPocket.com, enhancing health and privacy.